Senior Focus.
Kia ora koutou. This is Alex Bonham standing in for Anne-Marie Curie of Senior Focus. Welcome everyone, and today we're going to be talking about the future of Auckland City, what Plan Change 120 might do to it, what our aspirations for the city might be, and I have got three fabulous guests with me today, crossing heritage and historic areas, architecture and urban design. So let's first introduce Sally Hughes. Sally is chair of the Character Coalition, which is an umbrella organisation representing 65 heritage, historical and residence groups across Tamaki Makaurau. Welcome, Sally.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Thara Nelson, who is an architect in Tamaki Makaurau, is a member of Te Kahui Whaihanga New Zealand Institute of Architects, and examined students at the University of Auckland, and has been working with the RMA and on public architecture, schools, mixed-use development, medium density housing, arts and recreation facilities. So many, many things. Welcome, Thara. Thank you for joining us.
Kia ora. Thank you very much. Yeah, looking forward to this.
Brilliant. And we also have Anthony Vile, who I might call Ant sometimes. Anthony is director at the Urban Futures Research Lab, which is an urban think tank and design agency based in Auckland, New Zealand. So his professional body of work ranges from designing homes, but he's also very interested in the opportunities of evolving the urban landscape and his experience in leading teams navigating New Zealand's regulatory frameworks, which is not easy to deliver resilient, equitable and culturally rich urban environments. So thank you very much, Ant, for coming in. Hello, Ant.
Kia ora koutou katoa.
Kia ora. Right, so the context here is that Plan Change 120 is out for consultation at the moment and until December the 19th. There has been a big debate about whether it is heritage versus the high rise, but less conversation about the medium density, the mixed housing urban zones, which will make up the great majority of the planning in the future. And I'd like to get a sense of what that might look like and what might be better. But let's start actually with the debate a little bit between heritage and high rises and think about what makes a really good special character area and why, and historic areas and why people love them. Mm-hmm. And then we might think about what good high rises look like.
Yep.
Sally.
Sure. So, Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau is very, very lucky to have the special character areas that we do have. A report was written a couple of years ago by a graduate student who has his master's in architecture and from Auckland University, and he wrote a very good study that's aim was to review the existing literature on Auckland's special character areas and to compare the contents of our special character areas with equivalent urban fabric in other countries. So Joshua Howie's report came to the conclusion that we had the best in terms of quality and quantity collection of Edwardian and Victorian wooden houses in the world. And he did compare us to places like Melbourne, San Francisco and various other areas overseas as well. And we have this real tonga, was his conclusion, in Auckland. And we should really be making a lot more of it and utilizing it for tourism and certainly protecting it. So that's why the Character Coalition are very focused at the moment on protecting those special character areas. We are interested in the whole of Tamaki Makaurau. We have member groups from right across the city and special interest groups like the Tree Council. So we're very interested in urban trees as well. But right at the moment, the special character areas are under threat. And so we're we're doing our very best to protect those and to stop them being whittled away, which would you like me to go into how they have shrunk?
I think that's quite well known, that the amount has shrunk. This has been a debate for a few years. Mm, yeah. But I just want to ask, why do you think the people who live in special character areas, or even those who don't, why do you think they're loved so much, putting aside potentially their historic importance?
Yes, sure. And I think it's to do not just, as you say, with the historical way that they tell the story of Tamaki Mukawa. They show how the city developed. But it's more about the amenity value, the Section 6 of the RMA, you know, that neighbourhoods that have mature trees, that have a consistency of design and look and feel, are very pleasant to live in. So I think that's why people who actually live there love them. But there are a lot of people, myself included, who don't live in the special character area, but really treasure the fact that they exist, because they do anchor us in our story. They do tell people coming along from later who weren't born in those eras what it was like to live in those days, and they provide real landmarks for the past and going through into the future.
Yes, I can see that. Sarah, can I bring you in? You're an architect. When you were studying, or in your work now, how do you feel about the sort of the special character and the historic homes? Are you a preservationist, do you think, or are you a modernist, or what's your feeling about those areas and their value?
I would say I'm a context architect. Everything that I do, I take an interest in the context, and that's the social as well as the physical and historical and so on. So everything I do, I look at that context, and I absolutely, like Sally says, I absolutely love that whole business of character and what's going on. And part of that character is often the quirks. So there's the typical, and then there's also the unusual, and they all sort of meld together. And I think when people feel that these areas are threatened, it's when there's a dramatic bulk change, whereas there's lots of incremental changes that are often quite interesting. So that when I say dramatic, I'm talking about motorways. And we're just speaking about these special character areas and wanting to maintain them. I thought, well, one of the reasons that they've been threatened in the past is actually because people are trying to develop further out of town, and they put these big motorways in to get to them. And so there's this sort of irony that by not building inwards, by building outwards, you're actually threatening the inwards. So I think there has to be some reckoning between the two. Yeah,
I think that's true. But it's a paradox too, isn't it? Because I was told yesterday in St. Mary's Bay that a lot of the historic heritage and special character of the area was sustained because a lot of the rich people who lived in the area left when the motorway bridge came in. And it sort of didn't become an aspirational place to be. So places didn't change. And now we have a very interesting historic area that's now once again sort of like in the light of the developers who want to do things there. But St. Mary's Bay, it's an old area with relatively narrow streets. How practical is it to put in 50-metre tall high-rises there?
It's not very practical, and it probably won't happen. And what's happened with the, some of it will, but not a blanket thing like the plan change that's being put forward says could happen. It doesn't mean to say it would. It's more that the council were at this, trying to fit as many homes as would have happened with the previous plan change, which the government had basically mandated. So they've said, okay, within a certain walking distance from transport or working areas, then we'd go up. But it doesn't mean to say it would actually happen. So in a way, that's sort of something in our back pocket to know that, oh, well, if you can't do it, then you won't do it, even though officially it says that you're enabled to do it. Does that make sense? It probably doesn't.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Oh,
and that's
part of the problem, though, because although you're absolutely right, and this is what the politicians say to us quite often, it's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen all at once. But in a small suburb such as St. Mary's Bay, it would take one to ruin the character of, or Kingsland, for example, if there was one high rise right in the middle of those beautiful special avenues in Kingsland, that would, you know, oh, there goes the neighbourhood. So it's the problem that we have with Plan Change 120 is that it is all enabled all at once. And we think it would be far more sensible to maybe stage that intensification, bearing in mind that that level of development is 100 years supply of development. And so could we do that in maybe 10-year increments and go for the areas like round the station, the new station in Mangawhau, where there's a huge area of unbuilt on land, where it's crying out for towers and a vibe sort of precinct. You know, and we'd love that to happen there.
It's true. And yeah, the volcanic view shaft means it's actually all six stories, which could be just wonderful. Mm.
But even six, that gives you a lot more housing, and that would be wonderful with shops and.
Well, I think so too. Because what worries me is that what we've got, and I'm going to bring you in, Ant, in a moment, is that we might have the worst of both worlds here. Like, on the one hand, we're not going to get the housing because we're probably not going to get that much development in the 50 meter tower level. But at the same time, that it might have a chilling effect on doing some of the mid rise, mid density stuff well. That we probably want more of. Mm. And I was just wondering what your views are on the approach, you know, that's being taken. I know that you were a lot more involved in Plan Change 78 and in the RMA reforms that are coming up necessarily than Plan Change 120. But what would be your recommendation to any decision maker listening to how you might plan cities well?
Yeah, look, I have to say I'm pro-development and I'm also pro-heritage. I believe that they both can coexist, and they do internationally in all the cities we love to get on a plane and go and visit and have wonderful times in. I think, you know, New Zealand has, Auckland historically has been a single level city apart from amalgamations of density in our commercial centres. You know, there's a whole lot of factors that we need to address in terms of resilience and equity, access, how we move around the city, and how we think about not just character now, but what does future character look like? So what we consider character now, so if we take a long-term view, let's take a 150-year view, what's character in 150 years? Is it the stuff we're building now? Is it the stuff that was built in the Victorian era? Is it, or an amalgamation of all of that? So, you know, I think the whole plan change process, you know, is the council has to deliver some kind of strategy around where and what we build, right? My view is colours and numbers on a plan is maybe indicative, but not necessarily the way to really establish a clear pathway to deliver what I think we all want, which is an inclusive and a sustainable city. It's pretty clear that we all want that, right? With good design outcomes. We might have different opinions of what good design outcomes are, but generally we could all kind of agree based on the cities we like to travel to and we see as successful economically and so forth. We can agree what the outcomes might be. And you know, when you look at, for instance, Kingsland, so some of the push for height there, as you guys said earlier, it's not going to happen, you know. The volume of height-enabled intensity through there, it's just not going to happen. And it hasn't happened in a lot of other cities either. You know, you look at some of the cities like Paris, Berlin, some of those more intensive, older cities, you know, we're looking at 4 to 6 story type development, perimeter blocks, that sort of stuff, which is, perimeter blocks, for instance, are harder to do in a brownfield situation where there's existing buildings and so forth. But, definitely that 4 to 6 story is something that we should be focusing on in the first instance. And I think also, rather than just having the blanket planning maps, we should, and we really need to start, again, following the lead of what they do overseas. I mean, like in terms of master planning for precincts and neighbourhoods.
Mm. Yep.
Here's all the success we've had out in Hobsonville in terms of a master plan community out there, where we have, you know, a mix of 3-story to, I think there's some 12-story buildings out there now. But they're planned, they're considerate of their context, they're considerate of the place, and it's not just a blanket zoning. Wynyard Court are the same, right? It's a master planned community, a different scale than Hobsonville. But I think we really need to start looking at that in terms of our neighbourhoods, our precincts. What does a master planned area around Mount Eden or Glen Eden or Glen Innes or any of these sort of neighbourhoods which have fortunate enough to have a transport hub at these centres? And how can we plan about that and give sort of a range of densities around and a range of uses too, you know, so it's not just residential, it's not just commercial. I think we need to start thinking about blending our neighbourhoods so that you do actually start to generate the urban form and energy that we do see in other cities and is successful, and also generate a range of a mix of people and you know, affordability, all that sort of stuff lacking, which is just spread horizontally in Auckland. But what happens when we start to bring all that together vertically? And that's kind of what I'm interested in promoting. Yeah.
I think that sounds really interesting. There's lots of nodding from Ali and I.
Yes.
So you're an architect. What sort of incentives, what sort of approaches might help lead to those sorts of outcomes, in your view?
Okay. Well, I've been involved in master planning for schools where Ministry of Education say it requires this because they know. So this is a smaller scale in a city, obviously, but it's like a little city. And they know from past experience that people building in the wrong place jeopardises what happens in the future. And so you can see it in a very sort of obvious way with that sort of situation. So perhaps if developers were involved and were master planning, when the ones that you're talking about in terms of the threat is not sort of somebody building an extension in the back of their property, it's more the somebody buying multiple sites perhaps and doing a large development. And I assume the main concern is when people demolish existing and then build new and they build the 15 story because they're able to then. But if they are required to do master plans that work in, and I'll say that word again, the context. So they're looking at what's around them, what's been there, and what people really care about in that area. And also Anne's point about the whole affordability, to just enforce some requirement for having different range of homes, because it just gets really boring when you just have a lot of wealthy people or a lot of, I don't know, young people or a lot of old people or a lot of people who are never there because they're always at work. Community work, it's dull.
Well, we've seen, I think we can all speak to some fantastic master plan developments. I mean, I love Vinegar Lane as well. I really love the perimeter block, Freeman's Bay around Wellington Street and the marketplace sort of perimeter block. But as people often say, it's harder to master plan if you've only got one site. Though, I still hold to the theory that medieval cities, people had one lot and had one small lot and they built near the front of it and they looked forward and they looked back and over time a perimeter block would emerge. And I think that's probably how it worked, because I don't know that there were big scale developers in the 15th century, but I need to look into this more. But Jen, a lot of the development that happens is just based on one relatively large but single site, which is squeezed to the gunnels with as many townhouses as possible. And this seems to be playing out a lot out west, but also across the isthmus as well. And just thinking, is there a better way? New South Wales have got pattern books and form good. How can we make it easier for these infill developers to do a good job?
Yes, it appears to us in the coalition that what's been happening has been very much developer-led, and that's not a criticism of all developers, because there are some fantastic developers in our city. But it doesn't appear that there has been that master planning apart from places like Hobsonville Point. And that, I agree, is the key to making a city very vibrant and livable, that there is some planning and somebody taking that helicopter view and looking down and saying, where do we need this intensity? The minister did it in one sense by saying, we need that intensity around the rail stations to make the most of the use of the CRL, which is really sensible. But it doesn't appear to me that there's planning for the way people live. He's talking about the way people travel, but we need some planning about how people live. And I couldn't agree more with your point and about diversifying the uses within areas. You know, I'd love to see little corner bars and shops and things dotted amongst the
Come on, New Orleans.
Yes, yes. And they, to be fair, they did try to do that in Hobsonville Point. I'm quite familiar with it because I actually live there. And there were places designed to be little shops or bars or whatever. There was one on the corner that was still being built when we were there, and we went, yay, we're going to be able to just nip out the door and go for coffee on a Sunday morning. But sadly, they weren't able to encourage commercial businesses to take up those, and they've ended up just being houses, which is a real shame. So we have to find a way to incentivize people to take that risk, and maybe in the planning we make it sort of mandatory that those places are do have a commercial use.
And is that possible? How do you do that?
Well, one way is to just provide in ground in those sort of more intensive environments. And on corners, for instance, you might have a mandate to create flexible spaces on those corners at the ground floor, so they could be commercial, they could be residential, and because the city evolves over time. One economic environment may support a commercial or hospitality type use on a ground floor in a location at one time, but at another time it may not, or, you know, cultures change. So I think we need to think about flexibility in those types of situations. It's pretty hard to mandate you're going to open a cafe on this corner at this time.
Pickle thin.
But if you can include in your planning an aspect of flexibility, and then when the developer comes to lodges consent application, if he has met that flexible requirement and allowed or enabled that use at some time to evolve there, then he can be rewarded. Maybe he gets a height bonus or, you know, something like that. And the same could work for affordable units as well. I mean, it's a system that works well. Even in like cities like Los Angeles, you might have there's a site, and if you provide 30% affordable housing in it, then you get X number of extra meters in height, an increase in floor area ratio. You get a bigger development out of it. You know, so there's a benefit for the developer to do it. Right now, the benefit in doing that in our current planning context is, what is it? It's you get a tick in your box when you tool up at the pearly gate. So you've provided some affordable housing. Great. But,
yeah,
you know, that doesn't really count for much, to be honest.
No, that's true. And it also speaks a little bit to the density that you need in order to sustain corner bars and dairies.
Well, that's right. And so
a lot of it, of the mixed housing urban, which is the three houses of three stories that allowed most places. I mean, if you actually went to 4 to 6 stories there, then you'd just have more people, and they would sustain those places, which makes everything a bit more walkable. Just to go back to mature trees and greenery and landscaping, which is, I agree, I think that's one of the reasons why Special Character is so beloved. One of the reasons we've got Plan Change 120 is to avoid the risk of flooding. So I'm just wondering whether, on the one hand, we're avoiding some known areas of flooding, but if we concrete over too much, will that end up having flooding problems in other places. And how do we get the green space into the city so the water's got somewhere to go?
That's the council, isn't it? Getting that in terms of saying having shared green spaces, perhaps. So the council could get involved in that a little bit. Even just berms. It's not really great for congregating, but it's still a spongy area. Kaingaroa, which did recently got a lot of flack for being expensive, they have done some amazing work, though. They've done, I don't know if you've heard of Molly Green Park?
No.
Yeah, Keith Hay Park. If you like riding bikes, you ride it, you go over the motorway there, and there's a lovely overbridge, and you get to Molly Green Park. It's surrounded by Kaingaroa houses. Some of those houses, the roof water is collected, and that water gets put into a tank that's next to the communal garden that's within this park. I mean, it's just fantastic. I mean, I was so impressed when I went there and found out about all this stuff. I guess we can't do that everywhere, but that was that sort of connected thing that was happening with the thinking of houses feeding off the green area that they're next to, even though they're reasonably close together. It's great.
I think shared green spaces are great. Go on, Ant.
Kaingaroa had that opportunity because of the large landholding they had, you know, where they both take an integrated approach to development and work in that master planning space where they could have integrated outcomes, both in terms of green space, the integration of natural systems and stormwater management, and all that sort of stuff we're kind of aiming for, which just gets a bit harder to do in the private development space when you're just dealing, as you were saying before, with one site and rather than sort of an overlay of the whole neighbourhood. So I really do think we need to start to get into kind of that neighbourhood planning space, especially around the rail hubs.
I've just been told that time is running out, which is disappointing because we could keep talking for a really long time. We've only touched the surface of this. Can I please thank you, Thyra, Ant and Sally, for being with me today. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much. And to everyone listening, you can submit on Plan Change 120. Look on the Auckland Council website, have your say, and there's a friend of the submitter service there if you need support in making your submission. So
I'll say one more tiny, tiny thing. I say congratulations to the council. They've put together this whole massive document in a really, really short period of time. And I think the meaning is good, that, you know, that's well-meaning, and the submissions will only make it better. So I encourage people to submit. I am optimistic, to be honest.
Yes. The council are very keen for people to submit, so let's all master planning.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day, everyone. Kia ora.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus, and do note Senior Focus is one word.
104.6 Planet FM.
Whether you call it Aotearoa, New Zealand, New Zealand, or Nova Zelandia, it's worth knowing the history of the place most of us call home. Starting 100 million years ago and bringing us right through to modern day, the Aotearoa History Show explores some of the forces that have shaped this land and its people, from the geographical to the social and political. Produced by RNZ, the Aotearoa History Show airs here on 104.6 Planet FM every Monday at 2:35 p.m. And you can hear the full series anytime online by visiting the series and podcasts page at rnz.co.nz or using your favourite podcasting app.
We can become one of those rapidly growing groups who have the audacity and courage to believe that we actually can change the world.
Technology, entertainment, design, and much more. TED Talks brings you inspiring presentations from speakers across the world. Hear activists, experts and thought leaders sharing their ideas and stories. Wednesdays at 2 p.m, only live and only on Planet FM.
Wide open sea.
Such a green city.
It's big, it's new and it's different.
I love the